This podcast is intended for investment professionals only.
Hello and welcome to LGIM Talks. I am Lindsay Bass and I'm your host for today's discussion, which is an outlook on all things inflation in particular as it relates to hedging portfolios, hedging the risk of inflation, which many of our clients are doing through their LDI or liability-driven investment portfolios. So inflation, everyone's talking about it, it's on the news everywhere, but is it really a serious concern? Is it around for the long term? And what really are clients looking to do about it? To help me with this, I'm joined by three expert colleagues today. Firstly, with the appropriately named job title of Head of Inflation and Rate Strategy, we've got Chris Jeffrey. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Lindsay.
We also have Guy Whitby-Smith, our Head of Solutions Portfolio Management, who is at the coalface of markets. Hello, Guy.
Hi there.
And last but by no means least, representing our clients, we have Emma Rayner, who is our Head of LDI Distribution. Hi, Emma.
Hi, Lindsay.
So to kick off, Chris, I'm going to turn to you first. Can you give us a bit of context and a bit of background to the noise that we're hearing around inflation? Will it stay? Will it go? What are the drivers?
We've got very high headline inflation rates in both the UK and the rest of the world. I think we should just step back and say, well, what's been behind this and how does that make us think about it going forwards? And now I think we need to separate conceptually between two different things. So the first thing is the driver of inflation since the dark days of March 2020. And the immediate aftermath. So in the middle of the kind of worst bit of the pandemic, inflation expectations as measured by market prices had collapsed. Oil prices went as low as minus $40 per barrel in April. CPI year over year hit a trough of just 20 basis points. The vast majority of the repricing we've had since then is entirely healthy and should be welcomed by investors. It's the uplift in inflation expectations that's gone alongside the improvement in growth expectations that's gone alongside a massive recovery in corporate earnings and a collapse of corporate default rates. So it's all very healthy. It's all very normal. It all should be kind of embraced and welcomed. That's kind of exhibit A. And exhibit B is the drivers in the more recent past where we've had a series of headlines around supply chain bottlenecks. So it's been spiraling gas prices. It's been spikes in freight costs. It's been, you know, stories about lorry drivers being rarer than hen's teeth. That bit is kind of, we're now kind of getting into classic supply shock territory where there's uncomfortable trade-offs created with inflation higher, growth output, corporate earnings lower. So when we kind of talk about inflation, people kind of mix up both of those two things, like talk about inflation like it's always bad, like the fact that we've recovered so much in both inflation pricing and realized inflation is a 100% terrible phenomenon. I just really kind of caution against that. I mean, a large part of this has been the same story as the recovery in global equity markets and global credit markets. And it's only that additional bit over the course of the last few months where it potentially has these much more sort of negative ramifications.
So maybe not so all bad then. In terms of its permanence, could you provide a little bit of comment there? Because obviously when we're thinking about when clients' portfolios and hedging out their risk, they only really care more about the long-term persistence of inflation. Could you provide some comment there?
Yeah, there's been this tussle going on, I guess, in the rhetoric between team transitory and team permanent. Team transitory largely threw in the towel over the course of the last couple of weeks with Jerome Powell, chair of the Federal Reserve System, in aggregate. I think maybe the kind of interesting thing for me is kind of how the UK inflation market seems differently priced to other inflation markets. I mean, the UK inflation market has been priced for persistent inflation to be a consistent feature of the UK environment for quite a long time now. The more transitory pricing, so where we kind of see either the inflation curve inverted or longer dated inflation being priced below short dated inflation, is much more obvious feature of US and European markets. We don't think it's going to go away tomorrow. So we're not sort of in the, you know, this is all so transitory, you don't need to worry about it. If I was going to sort of leave one message on this, it's the more central banks worry it's permanent, the less that investors need to do the worrying on their behalf. So the more that the Fed responds and the Bank of England responds, the less you'd expect this to become a sort of runaway problem with no end in sight.
Okay, so that does bring me on to thinking about the Bank of England, because their approach has been over the last kind of, well, few weeks, months, a little bit inconsistent. Could you kind of comment on their behaviour and how that's affecting markets?
So the previous governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, got rather unkindly called the unreliable boyfriend in 2014 for repeatedly making kind of warnings about interest rates being about to change and then never following through. I guess in recent weeks and months, maybe there's been a bit more of a grand old Duke of York feel about the bank's communication. We were warned repeatedly that they would have to act, was the quote, in the run-up to the October meeting, and then failed to do anything at that meeting. We've had kind of warnings about policy hikes being imminent, and then most recently those have been watered down even for December. This has been in part, I mean, it's not the only reason, but it's in part what's been whipping the gilt market around quite so much. So we think it's just about 30-year yields as a number that's probably representative of a lot of liability-driven investors, the kind of maturities they're thinking about. They've been on a pretty wild ride. We were at 1% in August, up to 1.5% in October, back to about 90 basis points today. And that's all kind of coincided with this flip-flop in messaging from the bank. How do I think about that in aggregate? So if I mean, being generous, there's probably some confusion going on. What they're really trying to achieve, presumably, is to make the message clear to people on the high street who are considering taking out loans that they can't work on the assumption of rock bottom interest rates forever. Now, they've taken monetary policy off the business pages and put it on the front page. So to that extent, it's mission accomplished. To the extent that it's provided any clarity to money market traders or LDI investors, I think it would be quite a different conclusion.
Then that allows me to turn to our LDI portfolio manager. Guy, like, how is this helpful for you? What are the drivers that you're seeing in your front seat, so to speak?
Well, I think Chris there very helpfully talked about a lot of the underlying sort of macro dynamic factors that are driving inflation. But I guess the other side to it, which we feel is playing an increasingly major role in the kind of the price movements that Chris touched on there, is sort of simple supply mechanics. I guess if you sort of think about the short end, I guess it's quite easier to understand why we've seen very sharp moves in short-dated inflation. For all the reasons, you know, Chris just talked about, you know, coming out of this sort of unprecedented lockdown pandemic, you know, reopening stresses and alike. I guess what's really the focus on the LDI side has been what's happening to longer 20, 30-year rates, which you would expect and typically are much more stable than shorter dated rates, because yeah, they're not impacted so much by what happens over a single year. They're really talking about what's going to happen over the next 30 years. I mean, for instance, you know, 30-year inflation, you know, has risen by over 0.5%. It's currently, got as high as sort of 3.8%. And I'm always remembering that sort of in it's effectively with inflation now, effectively that's the CPI rate. So in sort of old money in RPI terms, that would equate to something like 4.8%. Now, these are really high levels of inflation. I mean, CPI is only 4% now in the mix of an inflation shock. To be sort of effectively saying that we're pricing in, you know, close to that level of inflation for the next 30 years, I guess it's much harder to point to supply chain issues, reopening bottlenecks for drivers of what's going to be happening into inflation in the year sort of 2050. So I guess what is driving this long-dated sort of price action? Well, really, it is supply and demand. You know, we're getting very, very limited supply of any kind of inflation issuance. While we're off the back of that, seeing sort of ongoing demand from pension schemes. We did have a inflation gilt syndication 2 weeks ago, and that was a new sort of curve extending 50-year linker to 2073. And just to put that into context, that syndication was 15 times oversubscribed, one of the biggest oversubscribed levels ever seen for an inflation-linked bond. And the problem you get there is it means that that demand out there just hasn't been saturated by the issue. And indeed, we've sort of seen the performance of that particular bond since sort of shows that there's sort of a lot of, sort of continued unfilled demand for very long inflation-dated issuance. I guess that's not a huge supply that's not a huge surprise, because we've just had so very little of supply. And we've got also a fairly unprecedented situation where we also know that we're going to get an incredibly low level of supply for the next 3 to 4 months. What we saw with the budget update last month was an incredible reduction in the size of the gilt issuance remit. It was reduced by 60 billion. It's by far the biggest ever reduction in the amount of supply being brought to the market we've ever seen. Essentially, you know, off the back of sort of the post, you know, the COVID recovery spending, assumptions were made about how much was needed to be borrowed. And clearly there was a lot of uncertainty at the time. So it's quite understandable in that context that some of those assumptions had to get revisited. But when they did get revisited with actual underlying data, it turned out the remit needed to be reduced by such a large amount. And all of that reduction was being taken out of what we're going to get in Q1. We know already that over the next 3 months, we're going to get very little supply. So the that combination has really meant that it's just driven up sort of effectively the price of inflation to very, very high levels. In terms of what we've seen in the market, I guess in the short term, there's been very little sort of willingness to oppose that move. It's got a lot of momentum behind it, coupled with the fact that, you know, inflation is the story at the moment, because you're seeing very high levels of inflation at the short end, which means in a short term, that trend could persist. In terms of what pension fund activity we've seen, we have seen pension funds adjust the levels of inflation hedging in response to this. We've seen a reduction in increase of inflation hedging. In 2021, we've seen more of a preference by pension funds to focus on interest rate hedging. And as Chris just articulated very well, there have been periods during the year where gilt yields have risen very rapidly in anticipation of Bank of England rate rises. And that is, we've seen pension funds taking advantage on the interest rate side to take the hedging, whereas we just haven't seen those opportunities on the inflation side, because we've had this persistently high inflation, both at shorter maturities and at longer maturities.
And Emma, obviously Guy's talked about how we've got this massive supply-demand imbalance, and certainly not from a supply sense is going to go anyway anytime soon. Do you want to comment on the client demand side of things? That's obviously where you're seeing activity. Could you comment a little bit on, you know, whether you see clients being particularly concerned by inflation? Is this just going to keep on coming? And what other factors are driving clients at the moment?
First of all, the great news is that for clients in general, over the last 20 years since we started looking at LDI, is most clients are now pretty well hedged against changes in an inflation expectation. So although it's a really, really exciting time, thankfully lots of pension schemes are sat there going, I feel like I've locked down that first order risk of inflation to quite a significant amount. I'd say, you know, the average is about an 80% hedge. So there's still some exposure there to these changes, but the quantum of that exposure is so much less than we're talking about 5-10 years ago. And as Guy says, you know, those clients are really looking to take advantage of this volatility by locking down interest rate risks even further, whereas the pace of that increase of hedging and inflation has certainly slowed over the last year. But actually, now that clients are sort of focused on this first order risk previously and they've largely locked that down, what they're now starting to really think about and talk to us about are these second order risks. So the risks that things like you're using RPI linked assets to hedge CPI linked liabilities. And we know with things like RPI reform, that's caused a lot of noise, and we've certainly had a lot of conversations around that. The other interesting one is around rising inflation expectations changing LPI deltas, which is a little bit of a technical detail, but essentially what we're saying here is that actually movements in inflation markets can mean that the level of hedging or the size of the hedging that you've created versus your liabilities might be quite different to what you expect it to be. And actually, as schemes are approaching higher hedging levels, they're thinking about the end game, they're further on in their journey, actually having a better, clearer, more accurate understanding of these risks is really important. And it's certainly keeping a lot of our clients up at night. So something we're thinking about in a lot of detail.
That's really interesting. Thank you. Can I just pick up for any of the more lay listeners on the your delta point? Is that down to the speed of the movement? Or what's kind of driving, you know, when you're saying that liabilities are not necessarily matched, you quite would have expected them?
So if we think about a typical valuation cycle for a pension scheme, that tends to be 3 years. So actually you're valuing your liabilities and then you might not be revisiting that valuation for a significant period of time. So actually, depending on when that point happened that you measured your liabilities, and if we think about it, a lot of schemes had that valuation point on the 31st of March 2020. We all know what was happening at that time last year. Actually, things are really markedly different. So for a lot of schemes, they're trying to work out how they can get a clearer picture at more points in time versus just actually this three-year cycle that's been so prevalent for such a long time in this industry. Things are definitely moving quicker.
So that's really interesting, Emma. There's a few things I wanted to pick up there. And Guy, I wanted to come to you on the RPI, CPI trend point. How has that trend affected markets?
Well, our hedging levels are high with pension schemes. That's typically with RPI, whereas a lot of our schemes do have quite sizable amounts of sort of CPI liabilities, which leaves them exposed to the difference between the two. Just around this time last year, where we got the decision on RPI reform, it was going to, after 2030, effectively convert all RPI to CPIH. And while that decision had many flaws, I guess the one thing it brought was sort of finally brought certainty to a conversation that's been going on for over a decade about the future about RPI. I have to say, it was thought at the time that what would happen as a result of that would be that we'd see very sharp falls in long-dated RPI, because historically the difference between RPI and CPI has typically been around 1%. And while we did start to see some of that coming through, in the end, the pandemic and COVID, effectively events overtook that reform story. And then with the subsequent moves we've seen, inflation being much more driven by the macro effects and the supply and demand effects that we were just talking about before, rather than so much around the RPI, CPI mechanics. In terms of what we've seen in the effect in the market, I guess it's had a few notable impacts. I guess one of them was the DMO was sort of holding off on doing any sort of curve extending inflation issuance until RPI was reformed. So that opened the door for the 2073 syndication that I referred to before. So that was certainly a very positive that we sort of finally got the return of 50-year supply thanks to the reform of RPI. In terms of what pension funds have been doing as a response to manage it, well, effectively, after 2030 now, their hedges actually work pretty well, because all the RPI they hold in terms of hedging assets effectively become CPIH, which will match either their CPI or their former RPI liabilities. So it really just leaves a sub-9-year now liabilities that are CPI-linked and mature before 2030. And we've seen a continuation of this trend of well-hedged schemes and well-funded schemes using CPI instruments, particularly CPI swaps, to manage this sort of sub-10-year, 9-year inflation mismatch.
Emma, I wanted to come back to you. You talked a little bit about, obviously, this kind of mismatch in timing around when people start building their liabilities and matching them off with their hedging. When thinking about the kind of later stages of a client's journey, is that more of a problem? And what are you kind of seeing as the client reaction there?
So it's certainly not necessarily more of a problem, but I think it all becomes about smoothing outcomes as much as possible when you're thinking about where you're trying to get to. Now, we know insurance portfolios are fully hedged against interest rates and inflation. So any mismatch you might have in your scheme, i.e. less than 100%, is going to cause some noise between how your portfolio reacts versus an insurance portfolio, which is particularly important if that's your end game in terms of a buy-in or a buyout transaction. Even self-sufficiency, actually, any exposure to interest rates and inflation is going to cause a mismatch of movement between your assets and liabilities. But interestingly, this whole dynamic of LPI movements and its delta, actually, for some clients, the worry is not about being under-hedged, it's actually about being over-hedged, which has been quite an interesting sort of behavioural finance type experiment that for so many schemes for so long, they've been running an under-hedged position and largely been quite sanguine about that. But suddenly, because of this changes in market movements, a potential over-hedge has certainly been causing some interesting conversations. So it's not necessarily a problem, but again, it becomes about the size of the risks that you're looking at. The first order risks, if you've largely managed those because you are a mature scheme with high hedging levels, it gives you more bandwidth to think about that second order in order to smooth towards your chosen outcome with as little volatility as possible.
That's really interesting. Over hedging. Is that a concern that's particularly warranted? Chris, I'm going to ask you, I like that behavioural kind of finance perspective, and I know your team love looking at behavioural finance kind of nudges, if you like. Is that a concern that's really warranted at all, being overhedged?
So it is a concern that's warranted, but it's really not obvious why it's a concern that should be more warranted than being underhedged by an equal and opposite amount. So I think this is a particular example of the emission bias in action. And that's a kind of slightly weird one where we attribute worse outcomes to things which are a direct product of our actions, and we attribute less bad outcomes to things which are an indirect product of our outcomes or a product of us not doing things. So we kind of somehow feel worse about the fact that we incur a loss from having actively overhedged than if we'd incurred a loss from seemingly passively underhedging. I guess from a sort of first principles perspective, you'd say your view about which one is worse should depend on how it interacts with all the other risks that you're running. So it may be the case that being overhedged against inflation reduces overall risk when thought about in the round of both the portfolio and the sponsor covenant, or it may be the case that it increases it. It'll be a function of what's the type of inflation shock, and it'll be a function of what's in the rest of your portfolio. But I don't think you can say from first principles that overhedging is any worse than underhedging. They both introduce risk on a standalone basis. that risk may or may not be additive to overall scheme risk. And I just think we should just be thinking about them the same. There's a neutral aspiration, which is to be as perfectly hedged as possible and to shut down both the first order and point out the second order risks. And I don't think you should be thinking terribly differently about being slightly over 100% than being slightly under.
Emma, I wanted to come back to you briefly, which is whether it's from clients being underhedged or overhedged in either direction. What are you finding clients are doing in this environment at the moment, and what kind of action? I mean, I'm not asking you to give advice necessarily, but what I'm just wondering what in terms of client activity you're seeing given this environment.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'd probably just echo what Guy said at the start, which is largely that the pace of increase of inflation hedging has slowed. You know, Chris has said, actually, people tend to regret a more active decision. So we haven't seen very many clients choose to reduce their inflation hedging as a result of these moves. But they're certainly keeping a closer eye on and perhaps delaying decisions on that in favour of actually working harder to capture opportunities in the interest rate markets, for example, or perhaps focusing on growth assets or credit, which are all important parts of reaching that endgame journey, as well as the inflation risks aspect.
So then thinking more generally about looking ahead and what clients can do, what markets can do, Chris, just to come back to you, do you have any particular, if I can ask, long range predictions for 2022? And while as challenging as it might be, what should clients and investors be looking out for as any leading indicators of what may or may not occur?
I'd go for a couple of leading indicators I think are important, both global and local to the UK. So global, I'd say the things you need to watch out for are the leading indicators of the supply chain bottleneck problem. So that mainly means to me kind of indicators of international freight prices. So they have stabilized and actually fallen somewhat over the course of the last couple of months, but having been ramped up enormously, you know, we're talking 500-600% over the preceding year. So if the problem around the global supply chain is going to get any better, one of the places you'd be expecting to see it would be in those freight numbers. So that's one kind of global leading indicator I'd point to. And then locally, a lot of the debate then is around quite how tight is the UK labour market, and quite how much has the decision to leave the European Union mean that the UK's got a dynamic which is different to other countries. And the things I'd be looking at there are self-employment and part-time employment. Maybe it's a sort of a little known kind of fact about the labour market in the UK over the course of the last year and a half is that there's been huge compositional changes with the pandemic. The entire drop in jobs we've seen since the early part of 2020 has come in those two categories. It's self-employment down kind of around 500,000, part-time employment down slightly less. So we're looking for those two to recover as a sign that there's actually more people who are going to be drawn into the labour market as it expands than had been the case beforehand. You asked me for long-term predictions. I'm not gonna come up with anything particularly earth-shattering, but just to make the point that we've had 12 months of unusually, unusually coherent government in the US with Democrats in charge of both the White House and both houses of Congress. It's not been easy, but at least policymaking has been possible and coherent. I think that's gonna not be the case if we were having this conversation this time next year. You've got midterm elections coming up, November next year. The administration's polling is terrible. The historical record is pretty clear that you get a swing away from incumbent parties. So this time next year, once again, we get to look forward to more kind of chaos and divided government in the US. So there's a cheery thought.
And Guy, finally, I wanted to turn to you. Any particular long-term trends from you, or any particular surprises that you're keeping an eye out for?
I'd say the long-term trend the trend we expect to continue is this one of sort of lower inflation demand for pension funds. And one of the main reasons for that is what Emma alluded to around the LPI linkages and how these higher inflation levels are going to lead to lower inflation demand. I think you're particularly going to see that next year as pension schemes have their year ends either in December or March and update their liabilities. Following that, you're very likely to see reduced inflation demand as pension schemes update those liabilities and actually see they're in better position from an inflation perspective than they were previously. I guess the other thing I'd point to, I mean, I talked a bit about sort of supply and demand, and I guess this is probably where we could see an inflection point, I think, next year, where once we get through that Q1 that I talked about that was going to be very low issuance, you've then got one of the highest net issuances we've had for some time going forward. You've got relatively high levels of government spending and issuance from the government, And at the same time, we've got no QE for the first time in quite some time. So I think you're going to again get this sort of shift around in the dynamics of the supply side. So I think both of those should point to, you know, longing and inflation sort of stabilizing and finding more an equilibrium point as we see all the pension fund demand coming down and the issuance coming back up.
Thank you so much, Guy and Chris and Emma. I'm going to wrap up there. I guess just in summary, it looks like looking forward to 2022, we've got some prospect of more supply, which should help over the longer term, but some political disruption. We've got clients' journey planning becoming more focused on the end game. So I guess it lends to the point that we've always made around LDI, which is that it's not a set and forget strategy and always kind of keep an eye on it. So thank you very much. And that wraps up another LGM Talks podcast.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcast app. It really helps new listeners to find us. And we're always on the lookout for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals only and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of the recording and do not reflect the views of legal and general investment management. Forward-looking statements are, by their nature, subject to significant risks and uncertainties and are based on internal forecasts and assumptions and should not be relied upon. Where individual stocks are mentioned, these do not constitute a recommendation to buy or sell any security and are for illustrative purposes only. Legal and general investment management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. To find more great content, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website, lgm.com.